Today is actually our last sermon in our series on the afterlife, and we've been having a really great series on heaven and hell. I've been particularly blessed by it because heaven actually has been a topic that has probably captured my imagination more than any topic over the last 3 years of my Christian life, and so I'm excited to tell you about my journey with it. It actually was about 3 years ago that I first found this book, Heaven, by Randy Alcorn, that you know we've talked about. I can't actually remember the circumstances under which I got this book, but I opened it up and I read the whole thing, and I was really taken aback at first by what it was saying. What the book does is it basically lays out every question on heaven that you could have, and it tries to answer it from the Bible. And the picture that was emerging from the book was completely different than what I imagined in my mind. And so actually, when I first read the book, I thought, I don't know if this is right. I was a little bit skeptical of it. And so I started to look at other resources. I listened to other sermons on heaven. I read other books on heaven. And I realized that the picture it was painting on heaven is the biblical one. And I had this strange realization that at this point in time, I had been a Christian for about 20 years. And I realized that for the first 20 years of my Christian life, my understanding of heaven was completely wrong. If I think back over those 20 years, I went to church every week, I went to Bible studies, I went to Sunday school, I did my devotional times, I did the things that Christians do in their lives, and somehow after all of that, after 20 years, the topic of heaven, which is so fundamentally important, I had completely misunderstood. And as the picture of heaven started to become clear in my mind, a biblical picture became clear in my mind, I started to realize that I had kind of lived the first 20 years of my Christian life with two hands tied behind my back. Because how can you possibly live life with an eternal perspective if you have no conception of your eternity? Or worse, in my case, you have a misconception of your eternity. And so with that in mind, it was around my birthday 3 years ago that I decided to make a simple change. Joanne and the girls asked me, what do I want to do on my birthday? And at the time, I was thinking about heaven, and I thought, you know, I want to go on a picnic. And so this is what we've done the last 3 years. We go on a picnic. We find a good place in Lexington. It's a secluded place, just a beautiful park. Lay out the picnic blanket in the basket. Have a picnic. And at the end of the picnic, when I have everyone's undivided attention, all my girls have to listen to me because it's my birthday, I talk to them about heaven. Because I do not want them to grow up with the same misconceptions that I did. And so we've talked about heaven each year. And it also challenges me to learn more about heaven each year. And what I talk to them about, some of the seminal passages in the Bible, are the ones that we're going to talk about today. So why don't we pray before we begin? God, I just pray for your Holy Spirit to be here. Heaven is a tough topic to imagine, so I pray that you would open our minds, open our imaginations, help us to come out of here today with a clear picture of heaven in our minds. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, the structure of today's sermon is pretty straightforward. I'm going to warn you, it's dense. But the first section, we're going to talk about Revelation 21, 1 through 4. And the question that I'm going to try and answer is, where is heaven? Then we're going to go to the second topic, which is Romans 8, 20 to 23. And we're going to try and imagine heaven and what does it look like. In this section, I really need you guys to use your imagination. And then finally, we're going to conclude with why all of this matters. And I'm just going to reflect more personally on that. So let's go to Revelation 21, 1 through 4. I will read it again quickly, if this works. Okay. Revelation 21, 1 through 4. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. Okay. I want to answer the question of where is heaven by talking about four misconceptions that I had that led me to the wrong answer of heaven's location. These misconceptions might seem not tied together, but they are, and I will tie them together at the end. So the first misconception that I had, and you can think, I don't know if some of you have these misconceptions, or maybe you don't, but the first misconception I had about heaven is that there's only one heaven. I had lived 20 years of my Christian life thinking that there's one heaven. If a Christian dies today, they go to that heaven, and that's the only one. But if you look at the passage, and I'm sorry this is not working, but if you look at Revelation 21, verse 1, it says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more." If you look at this verse, it shows that there are two heavens. There is a first heaven, and there is a new heaven, new earth. Why does that matter, and how does it work, and what's the difference? Well, the first heaven is the one that you go to. If you were to die now as a Christian, you would go to the first heaven. But that's a temporary destination, because when Jesus comes again, he's going to establish a new heaven, what's referred to as the new heaven and new earth. And everyone from the first heaven is going to the new heaven and new earth, and everyone who's a Christian on the earth at the time will be at the new heaven and new earth. So when you talk about your eternal dwelling place, where you will live forever, the place where that will be is called a new heaven and new earth, not the first one. And you may think this is a technicality. You may think it's something that only theologically inclined people care about. That's not true at all. Actually, when I think about my misconceptions of heaven, it all stems from the fact that I thought there was only one. I actually think if you only think there's one heaven, it is very probable that you will arrive at the wrong location for heaven in your mind. Now, why is that? Think about it. If a Christian were to die today, and they were to go to heaven, and that's the only heaven that there is, then unconsciously what we think is heaven and earth are in separate places. Heaven somewhere up there, and heaven can't be here. Why? Because we're still here, and this is not heaven yet. And so for my whole life, I had thought, well, heaven's somewhere up there. I can't really describe it. Maybe in the clouds, but it's certainly not here. And that actually might be true if there was only one. But there's two heavens. And when Jesus comes again, he will establish the new heaven and the new earth right here. And it's because there's two that it opens up the possibility that heaven will be on earth. The second misconception that I had is that the only name for heaven is heaven. I always thought of heaven as heaven. I had never known that there's any other name for heaven. No one told me that there's any other name for heaven. But as I started to study the topic of heaven and read the Bible more and listened to different teachings on heaven, I realized that there is a better name for heaven. And that name is the new heaven and the new earth. If you listen to Pastor Steve's sermon 2 weeks ago, he said that there are two itineraries in the afterlife. One is to the lake of fire. The second is to where? The new heaven and the new earth. Why does it matter that the full name of heaven is new heaven and new earth? Because earth is in the name of heaven. You can't think that heaven and earth are distinct places if the very name of heaven itself combines the two. It's heaven and earth. It's the greatest clue that we have on the location of heaven is in the very name itself, new heaven and new earth. The third misconception that I had is that we go up to heaven. That's what I thought. Don't we go die? If we die here, we go up to heaven, and that's the way it works. Heaven somewhere up there, we go up. But look at Revelation 21, verse 2. And I want to preview this verse before I read it. Andy, if you could help me with this, that'd be great. Revelation 21, 2 is in your bulletin. It talks about a city in New Jerusalem. This is considered the capital city of heaven. It's considered sort of synonymous with heaven. It represents heaven in this text. And as I read this passage, I don't have to use the remote. As I read this passage, I want you to look out for two words. Tim Keller says, when he talks about this passage, that there's two words in this verse that completely changed his worldview, completely changed his view on Christianity. And I want you to find these two words when I read the verse. 21:2. Let me go there. "And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." What are the two words in this verse that Tim Keller said completely changed his worldview? The two words are coming down. The Bible teaches that heaven, that we don't go up to heaven, that heaven comes down here. Listen to what Tim Keller said. "Coming down. Those two words changed my life. It changed the way I understand Christianity in many ways. The climax of history is not individual souls rising up to escape the material earth. What you have is heaven coming down and transforming the earth. We do not go up to heaven. In the new heaven and new earth, heaven comes down and redeems this earth. The fourth misconception that I had was that we go to be with God in heaven. That doesn't seem particularly controversial. We go to be with God. Isn't that how heaven works? But it's actually the exact opposite. If you read 21 verse 3, "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God.'" It's not that we go to be with God in heaven. It's that God comes to be with us in heaven. If you read this verse, it says the dwelling place of God is with man. Not the dwelling place of man is with God. It says that he will dwell with us and that God himself will be with us. It's heaven comes down, not that we go up. God comes to be with us, not that we go to be with him. When you look at the Message translation of this passage, and I don't always love the Message translation, but this time I really like it. It puts it this way: God has moved into the neighborhood. That is a much more accurate way to think about heaven than what I had for 20 years of my life. God is moving into the neighborhood. When you put this all together, when you tie all these misconceptions and take them away and look at the Bible as a whole, there's one truth: that if you are a Christian, if your name is written in the book of life, where will you spend your eternity? Where will heaven be? It will be right here. This is where you will spend your eternity. When I had my first picnic with my daughters and Joanne, I asked my girls, point to heaven. And Audrey kind of tepidly pointed up. Maddie then tepidly pointed up. Sophia, my youngest, had no idea what I was asking, but she saw her two sisters pointing up, and she said, "Up," with great emphasis. And I told them, "No, that's not quite right. Point around you. Heaven's not up there. Heaven's going to be here on earth." Tim Keller says again, "Heaven is the healing of this world. Heaven is the environment of God's glory that heals anything and everything it touches. Heaven comes down. It means the rehabilitation of this world. This is where you will spend your eternity. This is where the new heaven and the new earth resides." But what will it be like? After 100 inches of snow, the analogy of heaven coming down to earth is not the most appealing, I know. But Romans 8, 20-23 gives us a different framework to think about. And my hope from this section, my real hope, is that when you leave church today and you walk out those doors, that when you walk out, you'll be able to imagine heaven a little bit more. So 8:20-23, "For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it. Hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and the glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for the adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies." This is a great passage in the Bible. It's probably my favorite passage and my favorite chapter in the Bible. This passage is seemingly confusing the first time you read it. But let me just simplify what it's saying. It's saying that creation, this world around us, is frustrated. The reason I chose the NIV version is because I like the word frustrated. I think everyone knows what that feels like. And it's saying this world around us, creation, is frustrated. Why is creation frustrated? Because it says in 21, it's in bondage to decay. It's in bondage to decay. If you walk outside those church doors, look around you, and you'll see everything is in bondage to decay. But creation is groaning as in pains of childbirth for what? It's making the analogy to the redemption of our bodies. It's waiting for heaven to come down, as Tim Keller says, to rehabilitate this world, to renew this world, and to free it from its bondage to decay. And so the key to imagining heaven, the way to imagine it in your mind, is to look at this world, not look at somewhere else, look at this world and understand how it is frustrated, understand how it is in bondage to decay, and then imagine it without its bondage to decay. Imagine it being free. So let's start. Let's imagine that we walk out the doors of this church today. What do you see? One of the things that you will see is nature. There are trees on this street. You will see the grass on the lawns. You might drive by the Charles River. You'll see the sky. One of the things that you will see is nature. And it is very clear in the Bible that nature is in heaven, in the new heaven and new earth. Of course there is, because if the new heaven and new earth is redemption of this earth, of course there will be nature. But how do we imagine nature in heaven? We know that it's frustrated, but what does it look like when it's renewed? To that, I'll try and give you an analogy. Some of you know Ken and Helen Fu. They're friends of ours. They used to go to BCUC Chinatown. They since moved to California, then they moved to Shanghai. They've been there at least a couple of years, I think. Joanne and I saw them over the holidays in San Diego and at Christmas time, and one of their biggest complaints about Shanghai is that it's so polluted. The sky is gray. It's totally polluted. There's always this haze over that city. And if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. But if you go to San Diego, the sky is crystal clear, pristine blue. It pops. It is beautiful. It is gorgeous. It's even clearer than Boston. I don't know why it is, but it is a gorgeous, crystal clear blue sky. And they were just remarking about how beautiful the sky is. Now imagine you grew up in Shanghai, and you imagine you had no access to the internet. So you couldn't see anything, no media. All you know of skies is the Shanghai sky. Gray, we know it's gray, we know it's hazy, we know it's frustrated and polluted. But your definition of a clear blue day will really be a less smoggy day. It's still smoggy in Shanghai every day. If that's the only city you know and that's the only sky you see your whole life, you will never see a clear blue sky. That's just the reality. But you and I know that behind that haze, behind that pollution that's choking off that sky, is in fact a clear blue sky. We just can't see it when you're there. That's the way it works with all of nature. When we walk outside and you look at that tree, there is something more beautiful behind it. When you look at this sky, there is something more beautiful behind it. When you look at a flower, we have not even seen a beautiful flower because there was something more beautiful behind it, because none of the nature that we see is what God has intended, because nature is frustrated. It's in bondage to decay. But in the new heaven and new earth, it will be alive again. And I want to give you one tool to imagine it, and this comes from C.S. Lewis, perhaps the most imaginative, creative Christian writer there is. He writes this section in the Chronicles of Narnia. In the last book of the series, called The Last Battle, I want to set up this quote, and I'll read it to you. He talks about someone being in a home, looking out a window and seeing a view of nature. I think he talks about a bay and a valley and a mountain and so forth. And as the person turns away from this view, he sees what he calls a looking glass, which is an old English term for a mirror. And this mirror is reflecting exactly the same view out of that window. But what the mirror does is it shows it in its renewed state, okay? So let's listen to what C.S. Lewis says. This is his advice to you on imagining heaven. Perhaps you will get some idea of it if you think like this. You may have been in a room in which there was a window that looked out on a lovely bay of the sea or a green valley that wound away among the mountains. And in the wall of that room opposite to the window, there may have been a looking glass or a mirror. And as you turned away from the window, you suddenly caught sight of that sea or that valley all over again in the looking glass. It's reflecting the view. And the sea in the mirror or the valley in the mirror were in one sense just the same as the real ones. Yet at the same time, they were somehow different, deeper, more wonderful, more like places in a story. In a story you have never heard but very much want to know. The difference between the old Narnia and the new Narnia was like that. The new one was a deeper country. Every rock and flower and blade of grass looked as if it meant more. I can't describe it any better than that. If you ever get there, you will know what I mean. Notice that C.S. Lewis doesn't say, take the looking glass and point it into the sky and you will see heaven appear. He says the looking glass is reflecting the very view that you see out your window. It will be deeper country. You will see the bondage of decay gone. You will see the frustration of nature gone. And it will be deeper country. Every rock and flower and blade of grass looked as if it meant more. All right, if you walk out this church again today, what else will you see besides nature? You will see a lot of physical structures. You will see buildings. You will see roads. You will see bridges. You will see walls. You will see all sorts of physical structures. And it sounds very unspiritual to talk about physical structures. Who really gets excited about physical structures? But the Bible is totally clear that there's going to be physical structures in the new heaven and new earth. You will have a home. It describes heaven as a city. There's foundations to the city. There are walls. There are gates. There are roads. There will be a physical setting and physical structures in heaven. But will all of nature be what C.S. Lewis calls deeper country, and all the physical structures be dilapidated? I don't think so. And Jonathan Edwards, who is one of the great preachers in the 1700s, preached an entire sermon on this verse. I'll give you context for this verse. This verse comes after a section in Revelation 21 where the author of Revelation, John, goes into all this excruciating detail about the physical layout of heaven. Talks about how long it's going to be, how wide it's going to be, what's in the gates, these jewels in the doors, and all this sort of stuff. And after this long series of details about the physical structure of heaven, he ends that section with this verse. It says, "And the street of the city," this being New Jerusalem, "and the street of the city was pure gold, transparent as glass." Now, why would this verse about the streets in heaven capture Jonathan Edwards' imagination? Because it's actually quite profound. And I actually think if you come from Asian culture, you have a better chance to understand this. In most Asian cultures, I think, we take off our shoes when we enter a house, right? Why? Because we know the streets are dirty. We do not want to drag the dirt from the outside into the inside. That's why we take off our shoes. Joanne and I had a gathering at our house last week. It was a multi-ethnic gathering, so not everyone had the same sort of cultural backdrop. And one of the guests, when they entered, asked me, "Should I take off my shoes?" And I wasn't totally honest. I said, "Whatever makes you comfortable." And really in my heart, I'm thinking, "Please take off your shoes." And he didn't take off his shoes. And he started to walk around my house in his shoes. And with each step, I was pained. And then eventually, he actually did take off his shoes. Peer pressure is helpful. What Jonathan Edwards says about this verse and why it captures his imagination is because it's representative of all the physical structures of heaven. Because if you go to the best cities with the most exquisite architecture, with the nicest buildings, in the most beautiful places in the world, what is true? The streets are still dirty. You would still take your shoes off in any city in this world when you walk into the house because the streets are dirty. But if in heaven, the dirtiest place of all the physical structures in the world is clean, is pure gold, is transparent glass, what does that say about everything else? Listen to what he says. "In the most stately and magnificent cities in this world, however beautiful the buildings are, yet the streets are dirty and defiled, being made to trodden underfoot. But the very streets of this heavenly city are so pure that their being like pure gold don't sufficiently represent the purity of them, but they also appear like clear glass or crystal." He's saying the streets are so clean, so pure, that calling it pure gold is insufficient. The Bible has to go along and say, also, it's like transparent glass. It is so pristine. Look around the roads when you walk outside today. Look at the buildings. You will see, much like nature, they're decaying, they're eroding. You could say, in some sense, they're frustrated. But what Jonathan Edwards is saying is, if the very streets of heaven are just pristine and pure, then that means all the physical structures of heaven are going to be amazing. What else do you see when you walk outside of this church today? You see nature, as C.S. Lewis says, is deeper country. You see the buildings and the roads and the structures, and as Jonathan Edwards says, is pure like transparent glass. What else will you see? You will see each other. You will see believers, hopefully walking out of this church What will you look like in the new heaven and new earth? I want to be clear. You will have your physical body in the new heaven and new earth. That is entirely scripturally clear. And if you look at Philippians 3, 20 to 21, it says this: but our citizenship is in heaven, and from it we await a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body to be like his glorious body. See, we get an example in Jesus. When Jesus was resurrected, he spent some time here, as you know, and you can read him in the Gospels. What do we know about our physical body from Jesus' time in his resurrected state? First of all, we know that he has a physical body. We know that he walked and he talked, and we know that he actually ate fish. We know that the people around him could actually touch him, and we know that people recognized him. It was his body. But you and I know that our bodies today are frustrated. We all have insecurities about our bodies. We all have ailments within our bodies. We are sick. We are dying. We are weak. We get tired. Our bodies are in bondage to decay. They are frustrated. But what will our bodies look like in the new heaven and new earth? And 1 Corinthians starts to paint the picture. So it will it be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown is perishable. It is raised imperishable. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. Your current body is perishable. It's weak. It is dying. But your heavenly body, it says here, will be imperishable. It will be raised in glory. It will be powerful. And I love the way Johnny Erickson Tata says it. Some of you may know her. She's a Christian artist who's also a quadriplegic. She says, I can still hardly believe it. I, with shriveled, bent fingers, atrophied muscles, gnarled knees, and no feeling from the shoulders down, will one day have a new body, light, bright, and clothed in righteousness, powerful and dazzling. I love the last two words, powerful and dazzling. And by the way, and I could go off on this topic, if your body is renewed, and your body is powerful and dazzling, many of the expressions of your body will be powerful and dazzling too. Many of the expressions of your creativity will be powerful and dazzling. Some of you are musicians, some of you are artists, some of you are painters, some of you are chefs, some of you are craftsmen. The things that you will do in heaven, just like your body exceeds what you have to do, what you have today, your expressions of your body will exceed your expressions today. When you hear this worship team in the new heaven and new earth, I guarantee you, they will blow your mind. We should gather again in the new heaven and new earth and hear them. Your body will be powerful and dazzling. So as you walk outside of church today, I want you to look around you and just try and imagine heaven. Look around you and look at nature and look at the trees and look at the sky and imagine what C.S. Lewis says is deeper country. I want you to look at the buildings and look at the streets and look at the bridges and imagine what Jonathan Edwards says is pure as gold. And look at the people around you and the Christians and the believers that you're driving home with in church and imagine them and yourself powerful and dazzling. You have the opportunity to imagine heaven every day that you go through your life, and you should, because that's the only way we can have an eternal perspective. But you know, those three things will pale in comparison to something that you can probably better imagine inside this church. The most important way in which our lives today are frustrated is in our experience of God. Because we are sinful, because we are broken, we cannot experience God fully here today. In Exodus 33, it says, then Moses said, now show me your glory. And the Lord said, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for no one can see my face and live. In this world today, because we are sinful and fallen, we can experience God to a certain degree through the redemptive work of Christ, but we cannot experience God fully. We cannot see his face, because if we did, we would die. But in the new heaven and new earth, look at what Revelation 22 says, the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face. When we come to the new heaven and new earth, we will see the face of God. And I think when we see the face of God and we're with Him in His full glory in heaven, every desire we've ever had, every dream we've ever had, every wish, every aspiration, every hope, everything will be fulfilled. We will not be wanting anything, because we will be in the full presence of God. And our reaction to that will be worship and celebration. Sometimes I think when we hear worship in heaven, we misunderstand it. Because when we think about worship today, it involves our efforts to come here to church and a worship team to play. And we kind of got to get our mind right. And we kind of get into it. And then maybe every once in a while, we will have a great experience of worship. But in the new heaven and new earth, worship will be our reaction to being in the full presence of God. Hopefully that gives you a little bit of a framework to start to imagine heaven in your day-to-day life. But then the question begs, why does heaven matter? Who cares that it's on earth? Who cares that nature is redeemed? Who cares that we're going to be with God? And you know what? Heaven matters so much. There's one fundamental truth you have to understand, is that we all live our lives today with some belief about the future. If we knew that we were going to live 60 years, we would live today, right now, one way. If we thought and we knew that we were going to die 6 weeks from now, we would live today differently. So every day we live our lives in a way that is dependent upon our belief about the future. And when your future goes beyond this lifetime and goes into the security of knowing that you'll be with God in the new heaven and new earth, it should change everything. It should change how you think about evangelism and mission and stewardship and church and justice and everything. There's so many things that changes, but I'm not going to talk about any of those. And it pains me not to talk about any of them. I'm only going to talk about one. Because the author of Revelation, John, I think, had one primary intent with spending so much time about heaven in the book. Revelation is written to churches that are being persecuted. Revelation is written to churches that are suffering, to Christians that are dying, being martyred. They're suffering, they're dying, they're feeling the worst of this world. And the one thing that John wanted to give them is he wanted to give them hope. So he painted a picture of heaven. He painted the picture so that these Christians could persevere and live faithfully with the hope of a better day to come. Now, I know that you and I are not in the persecuted church today. But let's be honest. There are times when this world hurts us. There are times when things happen that break us. There are times where we can't even get out of bed in the morning. It is so hard and we are broken. And in those difficult times, I want you to think about the new heaven and the new earth and imagine the hope that all of your needs will be fulfilled for eternity with Christ. And when I think about a heavenly hope, there's actually one experience and story in my life which I'd like to share, which will wrap up today's message. I had a good friend. His name is Grover. He was a very good friend of mine from 5th grade through 12th grade. He was a schoolmate, obviously, and he was a special friend. He was a Christian. He came from a Christian family. But he was special because we were also family friends and we did a lot of things together. So Grover and I spent the summers together in summer school. That's what Asian kids did back then. We go to summer school. We were the three kids in math class over the summer. And that's what we spent our summers. Then we go back to school and all during the school year. And we were just together all the time. And he had an older brother, and I have an older brother, and they were the top two students in their class. And so Grover and I were always the younger brother of our older brothers all through school. So we had the same pains of being known as the younger brother. Grover was a tennis player. He played on the varsity tennis team, so we would play tennis together sometimes. We would talk about girls. We would do the things that friends do. And we were family friends in San Diego because we had a group of Chinese families, about eight of them, that would go every 6 weeks to different homes of each family, and it would be a potluck. You know how that works? You rotate homes, and everyone comes together. And so sometimes we go to Grover's house, sometimes they come to my house. And And so we were family friends. It was about 4 weeks, 6 weeks before my graduation, my senior year of high school. And my mother sat me down, and I just remember this like bright as day. I think I was watching TV in the family room, and she said, Larry, I need to talk to you. And she said, Grover has died. And I actually didn't know what to make of that at the time. I didn't actually ever really find out why, because apparently he went into the hospital for something routine, and something went wrong, and he died just a couple months before graduation. I didn't cry at the time that my mom told me. I didn't know how to process it. And I remember just a few days later going to the first funeral in my life. I had no expectation that my first funeral in my life would be for my high school friend. And I had no preparation for what a funeral would be like. I remember walking into the church service, and my eyes immediately caught what was in the very front of the service. It would have been right here, which is Grover's open casket. I didn't know that there were such things as an open casket funeral. And so I was actually quite taken aback and shocked to see Grover's body there. And even then, I didn't cry. I wasn't sure how to process it. But as my line of sight changed, I looked behind the casket. And if the casket was on the ground, behind the casket, standing behind it, on one side was Grover's brother, on the other side was Grover's dad, and holding up the they were both holding up in the middle of Grover's mom. And when I saw Grover's mom, I saw that she was filled with such grief and sorrow and despair that if they were not holding her up, she would have collapsed to the ground. Every fiber of her body was in pain and sorrow and suffering. And when I immediately caught a glimpse of Grover's mom, for even a split second, I started to weep and cry. And I cried all through that service. I cried all the way to the drive to the cemetery. I cried during the service at the cemetery when they were lowering the casket into the ground. And I sat there. I sat there weeping over Grover's grave. And I didn't actually realize what was going around me until my brother came up behind me and he kind of pulled me on the elbow and he said, Larry, it's time to go. And I realized that I was the last person standing there over Grover's grave, weeping, not because of my loss, but because I think that's the worst suffering that I had seen, which is a parent losing their child. In the days and weeks after Grover's death and funeral, I started to get little tidbits of how his mom was doing. She was going through a range of emotions. I think she felt guilty because 2 weeks before Grover died, he wanted a new jacket or something, and she didn't get it for him. And for some reason, that made her feel very guilty that she didn't get it for him. But she also felt, I heard that she felt great sorrow, and what she really wanted more than anything else, was just to have a normal day again. She wanted Grover to come home from school, knock on the door, and she could open it up, and he would be there, and she could hug him and hold him and go cook him his favorite meal and sit down at the table and talk to him. And she just wanted a normal day. She would give anything for one normal day with her son. That was her deepest longing. Over the last few years, after studying the new heaven and new earth, if Grover's mom was here, what I would say to her is that you will be with your son again. He will knock on that door. You will open it up. He will be there in the flesh. You will hug him. You will hold him. It will be the most familiar thing you know. He will be in your arms. You will cook him his favorite meal. It will taste so good. You will sit down with him. You will eat with him. And you will talk with him again. And you will do all of this in the new heaven and new earth. And you will be with him for all eternity. You will never be without him again. If you look at Revelation 21:4, it says, He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore. It's my sincere longing for you and me that we would not try and live this Christian life without imagining heaven. You cannot live life with an eternal perspective if you have no image of eternity in your mind. I hope that this whole series will be like a seed planted, where it will start to sprout and you will start to get a clear image of heaven in your mind. It may feel like we have covered a lot of ground in this series, and to some extent that's true. But I think it's even truer to say that we have barely scratched the surface of our eternity. And so my hope is that you will continue in the quest to learn more about heaven. And I'll close today with one last quote from D.L. Moody, who was a famous evangelist in the 1800s. He said, you may see in the paper one day that I have died. Don't believe it for a second. I have just begun to live. Let's pray.